As we began to cover the three occasions on which it is lawful to kill, I told you that the overarching idea for the next two sermons, and this would be the second of the two, is that the Lord makes allowances for mankind to take life. And here's the three occasions. We've already covered the first one. The Lord appoints public justice, the Lord affirms lawful war, and the Lord approves necessary defense. Today, we will try to cover the last two in one sermon. And our Old Testament passage this morning is from Genesis 14. It's a story in which Abram goes to battle for the sake of Lot and his household. And the reason I chose this passage is that it deals with warfare in a manner that is particularly helpful to us. It is more applicable to how the average nation should conduct warfare today. And I would caution any of us from attempting to use passages found later in the Pentateuch to build out a theology of lawful warfare for modern nations. And why is that? Well, because Israel in the Old Covenant served a particular prophetic purpose in redemptive history. Israel was a special covenanted geopolitical entity in relationship with God. No other nation like it has ever existed upon the earth before, during, or ever since. Israel was uniquely called to wage holy war in the promised land in a way that no other geopolitical entity has been commanded to live in their own land. So Israel had a particular assignment in a particular place for a particular time period. It was a particular political body which has now ceased. And it would be incredibly dangerous and foolish for any nation today or tomorrow or even 1,000 years from now to say, we're just like Israel. All the commands that God gave to them about warfare and conquering and driving people out of the land and committing holy war, we should apply that today. Right? Nevertheless, I think the Bible has quite a bit of wisdom for us about how to conduct warfare and how to defend ourselves. So having said that, if you would, stand with me now for the reading of God's holy, inerrant, and life-giving word, starting in Genesis chapter 14, verse 1. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, these kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shimeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is, Zoar. And all these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is, the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Sheveh-Kira-Athaim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who were dwelling in Hazon Tamar. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out and they joined battle in the valley of Siddim with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions and went their way. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and Aner. These were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions, and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, and the women and the people. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheva, that is, the king's valley. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. And now we turn to Luke chapter 2, verses 31 through 38, a passage with far fewer difficult things to pronounce. Luke 22, starting in verse 31. This is the words of Jesus. "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you, that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." Peter said to him, "Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death." Jesus said, "I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny me three times that you know me." And he said to them, "When I sent you out with no money or knapsack or sandals, did you lack anything?" They said, "Nothing." He said to them, "But now let the one who has a money bag take it, and likewise a knapsack. And let the one who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one. For I tell you that this scripture must be fulfilled in me." And he was numbered with the transgressors. "For that is what is written about me has its fulfillment." And they said, "Look, Lord, here are two swords." And he said to them, "It is enough. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever." Our great Father, we come before you now ready to receive what you have for us. May the Spirit be with us for the glory of Jesus. Amen. You can sit down. Not too long ago, I spoke with a jiu-jitsu coach who married his college sweetheart, and now they have a handful of kids, and they homeschool their children together. And he once said to me that the kids in their homeschool curriculum, they have two PE requirements to fulfill. First, they have to learn how to swim. And second, they have to learn how to defend themselves using jiu-jitsu. And I've talked to others with similar requirements, right? You have to be able to defend yourself in water from the water. That's called swimming. And you have to know how to get out of the deep waters of a physical confrontation. And that's where martial arts and combat sports are the scuba gear, right? Now, why would they set such rules in place for the kids? Well, the same reason any of us set any good rule for our households. It's an act of love. All individuals, even those who blaspheme God's name and rebel against him, they bear God's image. They're all his creatures, and the Creator cares for his creatures. We all live in the world that God governs. One cannot make Jesus the Lord of their life. Jesus is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, whether we like it or not. He rules all people with or without their consent. And he rules them well, with great benevolence and kindness. And Psalm 2 reminds us that the nations belong to Jesus. They are his inheritance that he has asked for from the Father, and the Father is granting it to him. So Jesus, of course, cares about the nations. They belong to him. Because he loves individuals who bear his image, and he loves the nations who are his inheritance from God the Father, Jesus gives both individuals and nations the natural right to defend themselves. If I had to summarize this entire sermon into one sentence, it would be this. The Lord Jesus loves nations and individuals, so he wants them to defend themselves from evil. That's the big idea. Because the reality is this. We live in a fallen world. We live in a world in which people will try to harm their fellow man without just cause. There are people who are willing to harm or even to kill just for the fiat currency in your pocket. And there are entire nations, starting with the government leaders at the very top. There are nations who willingly initiate aggression against another country, or other countries plural, for a whole host of various reasons. See, for no good reason at all, individuals will attack other individuals. And for no good reason at all, countries will attack other countries. But thankfully, God has granted to us the right to defend ourselves. But he regulates how we do that. He doesn't just say, yeah, you've got this right. Now go forth and figure it all out yourself. No, he sets the parameters for necessary defense and lawful warfare. He dictates how and when we can defend ourselves as individuals and as families. And he puts parameters and principles into place to determine how, when, and why nations can go to war lawfully. And Christians, by the way, can certainly participate in military service. We are not required to take up a position of pacifism or nonviolent resistance. We can meet violence with violence to defend ourselves or our country. Matthew Henry, the great Puritan in England, said this, note, our holy religion teaches us to be for peace, yet it does not forbid us to provide for war. Religion tends to make men not cowardly, but truly valiant. The righteous is bold as a lion. The true Christian is the true hero. So in other words, and this is the first main point I want to drive at today, is the Lord affirms lawful war. And I believe that by observing nature and by gleaning wisdom from special revelation, we can discern principles for waging war lawfully. For example, in the Western tradition, there is a 2,000-year historical development of what is known as just war theory. That is, the theory of how to wage a war justly. And this concept can be traced all the way back to the noble pagan Cicero in the first century BC in Rome. And then it's found in Augustine or Augustine, depending on how pretentious you are in pronouncing his name. And they'd be found in Thomas Aquinas. Even Luther and Calvin seem to pick up on it and allude to it, even though they don't really develop it out any further. And then, of course, A.A. Hodge in the 19th century here in the United States, he seems to espouse principles from it in his commentary on the Westminster Standards. And even Arthur Holmes, he's the most recent author to write about and defend this view in a major written work, to my knowledge. He's the author who defends the position of just war theory in a book called War, Four Views. Right? So he defends it and then critiques the other views as well. But in essence, the just war theory has two major parts. Justice in the process of deciding to go to war and justice in waging the war. But instead of spelling out for you a treatise on just war theory, I want to draw wisdom from three sources. A.A. Hodge, the actions of Abram as we saw them in Genesis 14, and then the wisdom of the Proverbs. And in doing so, many of the principles of just war theory will get articulated in essence anyway. So let's first consider the concise counsel from A.A. Hodge. You can actually find his commentary in PDF version on the internet on the Westminster Standards for free. So if you want to know what A. Hodge, who is the son of Charles Hodge, another great Princetonian seminary professor and theologian, if you want to see his commentary, it's free online. So this is essentially what he had to say. He said, it is very difficult to decide in particular cases when it is right for a, and here's an interesting phrase, Christian nation to go to war. Why would he say it that way? Well, let me just make a very brief comment. Back in the 19th century, it was still really obvious to a vast majority of people that the United States and England and Canada are to be articulated as Christian nations. But basically what he's saying there is some situations really are far more difficult than others when it comes to deciding when to go to war. And we should respect how challenging it can be to fall neither into the ditch of sinful aggression or sinful passivity. You can imagine why we would want well-formed, well-discipled Christians at the helm of our nation. The difficulty of such a decision as going to war or not must be undertaken prayerfully and wisely. The second thing that Hodge had to say that's interesting is this. War is an incalculable evil because of the lives it destroys, the misery it brings, and the moral degradation it infallibly works on all sides, upon the vanquished and the victor, the party originally in the right and the party in the wrong. That is to say, war is hell. Nobody really wins. Even the victors are touched by the misery of war. And with war comes a host of moral depravity. The temptations to sin that men will face as they're fighting a war and camped somewhere far away, or even as they're on a base somewhere preparing to fight a war. Those temptations are often matters not to be spoken of in decent places or during polite water cooler conversations. The third thing from Hodge that I want to bring to your attention is this. He said, in every war, at least one party must be wrong. Involved in the tremendous guilt of unjustifiable war, and in the vast majority of cases, both parties are in the wrong. I hope you can appreciate what Hodge is saying there. He's saying that in every single war, at least one side is in the wrong. There's no such thing as a war in which both parties are justified in taking part in the fight. But it might be that both sides are wrong. In a war, it is possible that there are two bad guys. It's possible that there's nobody to fully root for or fully support. Here's the fourth thing from Hodge. Lawful war is not about honor, glory, or aggrandizement, policy, or profit. Those things cannot excuse, much less justify, war. Nothing short of necessity for the purpose of the preservation of national existence can justify it. Hodge is basically saying this: you're only justified in waging a war if you're defending yourself. Spreading policy, like, I don't know, democracy across the world is not a valid reason to go to war. And going to war for profit, i.e. for resources like, I don't know, let's just pick a random one, oil, for example, it's not valid. Nation building, regime change, and fighting for financial gain, it's not lawful. And here's the fifth thing from Hodge. In order to make a war lawful in God's sight, our enemy must be aiming to do us a wrong. That wrong must directly or remotely threaten the national life, and war must then be the only means to avert it. Every other means of securing justice and maintaining national safety should be exhausted before waging war as the last resort. I want you to understand, he died like 20 or 30 years after the Civil War ended. So as he's saying these things, there's a very real contemporary thing that he's addressing. He's observed it. He's lived through it as a citizen. Basically what he's saying is this is all about national safety. It's not about national pride or the ego of politicians or a thirst for revenge. It's about another entity or country actually aiming to harm us in such a way that threatens our life as a nation or our existence as a country. And if all measures of diplomacy fail, only then can war be declared. Our founders understood this. They understood how dreadful war was as a thing, and we should avoid it if at all possible. We have to remember that during the War for Independence, it wasn't a revolutionary war at all, actually. It was a very orderly war. And in that war, it wasn't like just some guys one day were like, you know, I don't like how much we're getting taxed on tea. I think we should go start shooting the British. There's all kinds of letters written. There's all kinds of lobbying and correspondence and diplomacy and more diplomacy and more diplomacy. And eventually just diplomacy failed. There's a sixth thing from Hodge on the matter of war. A war may be purely defensive in spirit and intent while it is aggressive in the way it is conducted. In other words, a lawful war must be about defense, but a defensive war may take place in another theater and still be a defensive war. A defensive war may be waged with aggressive means. Okay, so like here's an example of how a biblical principle from the Old Covenant, from Deuteronomy 20, could be employed in a just way. In Deuteronomy 20, it's outlined for Israel, hey, if you go elsewhere to wage war outside of your national bounds and you come upon a city and you're about to besiege it, you have to offer them terms of peace first. And as you're using trees, as you're using trees to build your siege works, you can't destroy the fruit trees. So that's both a benefit for them and also for the people that they're fighting against. Because once the battle's over, if you take all the fruit trees, you've destroyed a food source. Right? So there's a mercy woven into these principles of just war, even in Deuteronomy, in which they were allowed to wage a holy war. Does that make sense? So if we had to push back on a nation that had invaded ours and we're driving them out and we have to maybe cross their borders a little bit to make sure they don't keep encroaching ours, we can offer them, we must offer them peace. And we must not lay economic, we must not lay waste to their economy if at all possible to avoid it. Right? So here's a summary of what Hodge is saying. There's difficulty in discernment. War is destructive in nature. There's moral degradation that comes. Defense, defense, defense. All in the letter D to help you remember it. Now let's make some observations from Abram's rescue of Lot. And this is why I want to observe this passage. Matthew Henry said this about Abram's war here in Genesis 14. He says, never was any military expedition undertaken, prosecuted, and finished more honorably than this of Abram's. Do you know how many wars and battles have been fought in the history of the world? That's quite the accomplishment. That's quite the statement to make about what Abram's conduct here in Genesis 14. Never, Matthew Henry says, no military expedition ever undertaken, prosecuted, finished, more honorable than this one. So I think it's then helpful, even if he's just half right, it's helpful for us as Christians to look at his actions in Genesis 14 and say, how did Abram do this? Well, first of all, Abram had a really good reason to wage war. He's going to battle to rescue his own people. He's not seeking vengeance, right? He doesn't go get his people and then wipe out some other people. No, he literally, he's not seeking his own glory at all. It's not protecting his own pride. He's not expanding his lands or lining his own pockets. He's fighting a battle as a part of a larger defensive war involving his own allies, and he's simply taking back what belongs to him, right? Lot is his people. That's part of his people group. Lot's stuff, their possessions, that belongs to them. And, you know, his call to engage in battle was clear. It's a very orderly war. Abram's not just some guy stirring up like some sort of militia to go off and get back Lot. He's the head of a new nation. He's the head of a budding people group. He's the only one in his household who can call his people to war. And that's what he does. It's implied that he makes the formal declaration and decision, organizing their objectives and tasks. Like I said, a very orderly war. He's the right man to make this decision, and he makes it. And you know, who did he take into battle with him? Did you catch what it said in the text? His armed, trained servants, born in his house. He did not take women and children to battle, nor did he take men ill-suited for the task. He didn't take untrained men into war. Let me just say this. There might be, as we said earlier, two bad guys in a war. But you want to know how you spot the bad guys in a war real quick? See who's throwing women, children, mentally handicapped people, elderly men, and young men incapable of fighting. See who's throwing them in their ranks to fight. And that'll let you know what's what real quick. Because war is meant to protect, to defend those types of people from war. Furthermore, Abraham made his attack by night. Why? To give his men the greatest chance of success against a greater force. He was trying to limit the amount of loss of life. It was the most careful thing to do regarding the life of his own men. You see, men who follow the Lord are not careless with the lives of image bearers. Now, some have said, you know, hey, I don't understand this. Why was this necessary? Couldn't Abram just have recovered Lot by ransom? He could have come to these people and said, look, I'm a very rich guy. I've got lots and lots of goats and sheep, and, you know, I've got money. What do you want for my nephew Lot? But you see, you need to understand the cultural context. Women and children, those possessions, those are now trophies of war. People in that culture did not, they didn't get ransomed. You could get ransomed if you were like a dude of nobility, of noble stature and status, like Lot, who was a very wealthy guy. But no one else is probably getting ransomed. So the only way to rescue the women and children and the possessions is to fight a battle, to get them all back by night. And you see, men who follow God in the Bible, while very flawed in many ways, compared to their contemporaries, they treat women and children with far more dignity and value. Abram went to war to recover all of what was stolen, not just his nephew. And you'll notice how far he pursues his enemy as well. He did not wage a war of annihilation. He's not looking for vengeance. He doesn't say, I got all my stuff back. Now I'm going to destroy all of yours, burn it to the ground. He didn't wipe them out. He drove them back as far as necessary to recover his people and defend his land and the land of those that he was allied with at the time. You'll notice he drives them as far as what? Dan. Where is Dan? It's in the promised land, right? See, Abram is quite level-headed and even-handed in the violence that he doles out. He only doles out the violence necessary to end the conflict and bring peace. I would even say, compared to other men, he was merciful and generous. How many other men in his culture, after recovering Lot and the women and children and all possessions, would have said, we now have a feud for the rest of my life. I am not going to rest until all of your wives and all of your children are in my possession. Honestly, would you just do a cursory reading of history? That's how it usually goes. But not with Abram. So there's lessons for us to take about how to wage war well from the life of Abram. And then there's also wisdom from the Proverbs that apply to war. And you might say, what do the Proverbs have to do with lawful war? Well, Lady Wisdom, personified in Proverbs chapter 8, verses 15 and 16, actually says this: by me, she says, kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me, princes and nobles rule, all who judge rightly. And of course, Proverbs 1:33 lets us know that by wisdom we dwell securely. So if we want security in our nation or our country, whatever, wherever we are, we must have wisdom. We have security in our relationships and our marriage and our family life. Wisdom is needed. And the Bible explicitly states, as I've already mentioned, that kings need to rule by wisdom. It's the only way to do it. Proverbs tell us that we should avoid joining with those who are eager to take life. Bloodlust is unlawful, especially the shedding of innocent blood, which in the context of war would be non-combatants. And that's one of the principles of just war theory, non-combatant immunity. You don't target women and children. Now, if a 10-year-old child decides, I'm going to put on my big boy pants and I'm going to carry the AK-47 and I'm going to carry grenades into battle, that's an unfortunate decision that that child and the adult who should know better in his life, that's an unfortunate decision that's been made. He is now a combatant, and it's very sad. But in general, in the context of war, a child to be considered a non-combatant. Proverbs instructs us to only contend with someone else if we have cause. Proverbs basically say, don't just have strife for no reason. Don't just stir it up. But even then, as the Proverbs say elsewhere, mercy is good for us. It's good for others. And cruelty, in addition to harming the target of our cruelty, it also harms us. The Proverbs warn women against tearing down their own houses from the inside. And in warfare, it is a very real possibility that a nation can bankrupt itself and destroy itself from the inside out by fighting too many wars and spreading themselves too thin. Anybody ever heard of the Roman Empire? Case in point, they're the poster child for this. And there's been several others. Proverbs remind us that a gentle answer turns away wrath and overlooking transgressions and using discretion in doing so, it's a boon to those with the wisdom to do it. The Proverbs tell us that avoiding strife is an honor for a man. And we should avoid associating with angry men and men who are prone to strife. And the Proverbs also warn us about meddling with boundary lines and envying others for their wealth. And I think that this doesn't only apply to the ancient boundary lines in Israel or envying an individual neighbor. I think countless wars throughout history have been waged to try to recover this ancient boundary line that was stolen from our ancestors hundreds upon hundreds of years ago. Well, all that does is lead to more death, doesn't it? And even if the old boundary lines are recovered by war, they often aren't worth the cost in blood. There might be some exceptions to that. But certainly, we would say without exception, it is never good for one nation to envy the prosperity of another or their resources and go to war with them to try to take what they have. Now, I believe that it was A. Hodge that said that international defense is basically just individual defense at scale. He reasoned that if God grants the right to people to defend themselves, of course he would grant it to them to defend themselves as a whole people. So we're kind of moving backwards from international conflict resolution to interpersonal conflict, but it needs to be stated that the Lord approves necessary defense. You can see this in Luke 22. You can see it in Exodus 22. There's counsel from Jesus, right, given at the end of his life before he's betrayed. He's telling his disciples, you guys got swords? And they're like, yeah, we got two of them. And he says, it's enough. If the moment comes that you need to defend yourself and you don't have a sword to defend your life, you'll wish you had sold something else in order to buy a sword. Robbers and would-be murderers have a greater chance of success if you are weaponless. Luke 22 is a reminder of how dangerous the world can be and that no man amongst other men should think they're all safe without arms. See, just think about it this way. The sword of the Spirit is necessary to defend ourselves spiritually, but how do we defend ourselves physically? See, this is important to think about because we're both body and spirit. The Christian view of the body and the soul is not that like we're really a soul trapped in this body and we just got to get free. No, we are embodied souls. We are physical and immaterial. We're both. Jesus cares about both, and he gives us the means to defend both. And just as the sword of the Spirit today comes with various letters marked upon it, like ESV or KJV or NASB, so too modern swords come marked with letters like GLOCK and SNW and HK, and you get the point. Now, I'm not saying we should hope for trouble or long for it. We shouldn't. But we should be soberly prepared. You see, Jesus is not opposed to self-defense or our readiness to protect innocent life. Here in Luke 22, Jesus seems concerned for their protection. Now, I don't know how, if you read this passage like I do, you're going to look at this conversation between Jesus and the disciples and say, there's 11 of them, and they have two total swords. They need nine more. That's exactly why some commentators look at this passage and think that Jesus saying, it's enough, he's being ironic. Right? But, you know, in a crowd, two swords amongst nearly a dozen men together, that's better than nothing. And you might wonder why the Bible doesn't speak more about self-defense. Well, the Bible doesn't say much about drinking water or dressing yourself when it's cold and so on, because it's so natural. The Bible doesn't instruct us to breathe, right? Nor does it tell us about the greenness of grass or the wetness of water in all kinds of elaborate and detailed ways. And yet we get it. See, I think human beings have to be trained out of understanding that they naturally have a right from their Creator to defend themselves. And the Word of God does give us some wisdom about self-defense. Take the case of Exodus 22, verses 2 through 3. The passage says this: if the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guilt on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guilt on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, he shall be sold for his theft. Now, there's two opinions about what those verses are saying. The first opinion is that, look, what the Lord is saying is that if a guy breaks in at night, you don't know what his intentions are because it's dark, and you can fight him off, and if he dies in the process, you're fine. You're not a murderer. You're not guilty of any sort of crime. But, you know, if he breaks in during the daytime, you can plainly see if he's armed or not, and you can determine and discern what his intentions are, and so you can't kill him. You can't strike him, but if you do and he dies, then you're guilty. You've got blood guilt. I don't buy that. This is the second view. This is my view. I think what the Lord is saying is, look, if you catch a thief breaking into the house at night, which is most likely when a thief is breaking in, culturally speaking, because they're trying to get away with it, they're trying not to be seen. Most people are living very close together in this context, and so nighttime is when you would do this, right? He breaks in at night, and he engages you, and you kill him. You're not a killer. You're not a murderer. You're not guilty of a crime. But if you go after him the next day in broad daylight and kill him for what he's done, you've got blood guilt. Right? If you go to get your stuff back and you fight with him and you strike him and you kill him, you're guilty. There's a process of him making restitution, of him being found guilty. There's a process of getting your stuff back, and you can't just go handle it on your own and kill the guy. I think that makes way more sense than the other interpretation of that passage. Just because someone breaks in during broad daylight doesn't mean you can quickly and accurately discern the true level of danger that you're in. It doesn't. Hey, since it's daylight, let's have a conversation. What are your intentions here? You just want my TV? Right? You're going to threaten me or my family? Like, what are you after? The shoes, they're all right by the door. You after the car? The key fob's right there. Like, what are you? It's not going to happen. That's a fantasy, right? Well, you know, if it's daylight, you could see if he's armed. He's got a shirt. Concealed carry is a thing. A knife can be pretty much anywhere, in the sock, in the pocket. You have any clue. It's just absurd to expect that just because it's broad daylight, we can discern all the details that are pertinent to the life or death situation we may or may not be in really quickly. No, it's just not the case. It makes sense to me that this is a prohibition against someone tracking down the thief during the following day and exacting revenge by striking or killing them. That is not self-defense. You have the right to defend your life, your homes, and the lives of other innocents, but we have not been all universally deputized by God to play the role of law enforcer, right? Now, you might ask, Pastor Nate, what about the command from Jesus in the book of Matthew to turn the other cheek? Well, the context there seems to be about personal offenses. It's not about a thief. It's not about someone committing a crime or actually trying to hurt you. If someone slights you, turn the other cheek. There's no threat to your life. Overlook it. Forbear with them in love. If they're an enemy, return their venom with kindness. And in doing so, as the Proverbs and as Paul quoting the Proverbs in Romans says, you heap burning coals upon their heads. Let me give you some other cautions from the scriptures. First, consider the words of Paul in 1 Timothy 5:8. This is a striking comment. He says, the man who does not provide for his family is worse than what? An unbeliever. What's one of the basic things that we are as men to provide for our wives and children? Safety, protection. We're to possess as men the ability to defend them to the best of our ability, to the best of what is provided for us in God's providence. Jesus even makes the point in Luke 11, verse 21, that a fully armed strong man who guards his own house has created a safe property. Now, you might say, Pastor Nate, I don't own a gun, and I don't know what to do. I wouldn't know what to do with one if I bought one. You're in luck. We live in the great state of Tennessee. They're everywhere. Right? You're in luck. We don't just have a law enforcement officer that works here. He's a member of the SWAT team, totally capable of teaching you how to use a gun. Not only that, we have a member of the Army in our congregation as a member, a Green Beret. I'm pretty sure these guys are qualified to help you figure this out. There's no excuses. If someone breaks into your home and kills you and your family, you're not martyrs, just become your Christians. I can't believe I have to explain this to people. But I have to, because pietism and pacifism is so infected the church today. There are people that literally think, they've literally said to me, you know, I don't own a weapon. If someone breaks into my house and steals my stuff and the process of all that kills me and my family, we're believers. I'm happy for us to be martyrs for the faith. That doesn't make you a martyr. It makes you a moron. It's a complete difference. You know what a martyr is? A martyr is someone who's killed because they're explicitly bearing witness to the resurrected Lord Jesus. If someone breaks in just because they're a madman who wants to kill and steal, you're not a martyr. You're a victim. It's different. If one does not possess the tools or the will to defend their life and property from robbers and killers when they have the choice to do so, it's the opposite of being noble. So, brothers, defend yourself and your families. And on a slightly larger scale, you know, we see in Nehemiah 4 how men rallied together to protect their community that was under assault. Men mounted a force in defense of their neighborhood, in defense of their town. So may we have the courage and good sense to be such men. Secondly, while weapons are lawful to own, possess, and wield, we must remember that our ultimate help is in the Lord. He trains our hands to fight. David had the wisdom to know that the bow and the sword are not where he would place his final trust. The battle belongs to the Lord. And I fear that that is not a mistake that we can make either. We can neither test the Lord in our ignorance, nor can we fail to trust him in our arrogance. The pro-Second Amendment culture is filled with all sorts of temptation to trust in all the latest tech and gadgets and training, which by all means, have the tech and training, for sure, go for it. But it gets to the point where we can lose sight of the most important source of power, and that is God. He kills and he makes alive. He wounds and he heals. It's all in his mighty right hand. It's all in his power. And lastly, let me caution us all away again from bloodlust. The day that anyone has to draw a weapon or to use their martial arts skills to defend their life or the life of another, well, it's most likely going to be the worst day of their life. Taking the life of another, even if they're evil and attacking an innocent person, it is traumatic and dark. It's sad and grievous. It stays with you for a long time, maybe for life. It's nothing to daydream about. When you go to the range or when you go to the mats to train, you are training for the worst day of your life. But you're training so that worst day is not your last day. See, the worst day of your life can be even worse if you're not equipped for the task at hand, right? Now, personally, I, for one, am thankful that eventually Christ will be in our midst and dwell with us forever, and all wars and personal conflict will cease. That's the ultimate hope that we have. It's that the consummation of all redemption is coming. War amongst nations, filled with individuals who bear the image of God, it's nothing short of hell on earth, and eventually that hell on earth is coming to a close because heaven will be on earth. Heaven and earth will meet. See, war is not the way it's supposed to be. War is not normal. You understand the difference between something being normal and being common? War's common, but it ain't normal. War in no way, shape, or form is how it's supposed to be. But Jesus will return and set things right. War is a consequence of sin. It destroys image bearers left and right. But because Jesus is the King of the whole world, and because we bear His image, and in redemption that image is being more and more sanctified and conformed into His likeness, it makes sense that Jesus gets to regulate war and self-defense by His word. And His grace does not abolish our nature, but rather it takes our nature to its pinnacle. So as Christians, we can thoughtfully and carefully serve in combat to defend our nation. And as citizens, we can defend our own lives. We're blessed by God's providence to live in a free state like Tennessee, in a nation like America, that allows us to exercise the God-given right to defend ourselves. You need to understand, the right to self-defense is not given by the government, it's given by God. And we should thank the Lord that we live in a land that acknowledges that, at least for the time being. We should not take it for granted. And yet, we should ultimately recognize that we live as people with an ultimate citizenship in heaven. Our ultimate loyalty is to His kingdom. And so when the kingdoms of the earth rage against Him and rage against one another, we are to stand with Christ and plead His cause. His crown rights as the Lord of all must not be ignored by any man or any nation, because anyone who opposes Christ opposes the rightful ruler of all peoples. Let the hearer understand. Let's pray.